Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Kuhner. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis of practical application that you can take back in the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know that BIC has been issuing pen test licenses for decades?
That's impressive. Maybe that's where I should be going. I bet they don't pay as well, though.
Well, it's hard to say.
That's fair. All right. Singapore to license pen testers and managed InfoSec operators from the register.
You know, they should have had a better headline. I'm disappointed.
It is from the register. Register is usually good. And yeah, sounds pretty boring. So the Cybersecurity Agency of Singapore has proposed a licensing framework that requires companies to provide SOC and penetration testing services to other companies to get licenses. They will need to satisfy regulators that they are fit and proper people. They must apply by October 11th, 2022 for the required licenses, and they will cost 500 Singaporean dollars for individuals and 1,000 for businesses, which in US dollars is $365 and $730, and is good for 2 years. There's a fine of up to $50,000 Singaporean and up to 2 years in jail for working without one. That's a pretty hefty fine.
Yeah. So they're going to be like, no, in 2 years when you get out of jail, you could have applied for a new license.
Yeah, that is true.
So this new regulation actually comes out of a previous law called the Cybersecurity Act of 2018. And that was indicated in part five of that this was coming down the pipe.
So they've had 4 years, I guess, or is this a modification? Do we know?
No, the Cybersecurity Act 2018 said we will do this. And so now they are getting around to doing what they said they were going to do.
That makes sense.
So what we're going to be discussing throughout this article actually comes from three different documents from Singapore that relate to this. So you have the industry consultation paper on the licensing framework for cybersecurity providers, the closing note to the industry consultation on the licensing framework for cybersecurity providers, and the Cybersecurity Act 2018, a Cybersecurity Service Providers Regulations 2022.
I love it when you talk laws to me.
Yeah, doesn't everyone?
So it sounds like there are three considerations that they're trying to do here. Provide greater assurance of security and safety to consumers. Singapore has said that this will protect customers and improve practitioner standards. Has this ever been true that licensure has protected customers and improved standards?
I don't believe so, but they will certainly claim it. I mean, that's why you have virtually all the regulating bodies that are ever in existence, because they claim to do these things, right? Ever since, you know, way back Upton Sinclair, the jungle, whatever come out of that and said, oh, well, we need like an FDA to prevent this stuff. So the same kind of thing. It's old as time, just about.
Yeah, I know that's one of the reasons. I think if I remember correctly, to become a hairdresser, or maybe it's doing nails or something, doesn't it require like almost a year of training and stuff to become one of those in some states?
Yeah. And there's also there's required hours of training. So you have to undergo X number of hours of training before you're able to get licensed or whatever.
Yeah. Yep. Oh.
So the second one is improve the standards and standing of cybersecurity service providers. But just this statement, the way that they wrote this seemed odd to me, because just because there's a qualified list does not improve the standard itself. I mean, and it's possible that everyone who's currently participating in this would already meet those standards without the paper. The paper doesn't improve the standards. And I don't understand what the role of government is in improving the standing of cybersecurity providers.
They should be the purpose of the market.
Exactly. Their reputation should be what improves or increases or decreases their standing within the market. Giving them a piece of paper should not have any bearing on their standing. within the cybersecurity community or with their customers. And finally, it'll be to address the information asymmetry between consumers and cybersecurity providers. And this sounds kind of odd, but I think what they're getting at here is to say that, you know, if you go to hire a cybersecurity professional to test your pens or you know, whatever it is you're going to do, hire an MSS or whatever, that you don't know what a good cybersecurity company is or what it means to be a good pen tester. So the people you are trying to engage in commerce with have more information than you do. And that's the asymmetry of information, that you are less knowledgeable than they are. And supposedly that will mean that you could be taken advantage of by these horrible capitalists. But if the government says that these people have gotten a piece of paper from them, that means that you can be assured that you're not being ripped off.
Well, so I have two thoughts on that. Number one, I agree that there is an information asymmetry, but we're going to go into what the license requires, and nothing in the license requirements addresses that asymmetry. Like, the best way to address the asymmetry is to go talk to other customers of who you're going to use.
I mean, if you want to address this asymmetry problem, develop a Yelp for cybersecurity companies or something like that, which can provide the feedback on what they got out of that company and what their value was to them.
Yeah. And especially in pay people to actually put in their reviews, because people frequently don't put in the reviews because there's, you know, it takes time out of their day to do it. And you get people that really love the company or people that really hate the company. And that's about it. People that were like, I had an okay time with the company generally don't participate because they don't care enough.
Right. Yeah. And this kind of boils down to, this is just going to be like compliance. You know, just because you're compliant and have the government piece of paper does not mean that you're actually going to know what you're doing or be good at what you do. I mean, how many CISSPs have you talked to, or people with an MCSE where you're like, oh man, I wouldn't want this guy, you know, watching my goldfish, let alone my network.
Yeah. I mean, it's always the same thing, right? Passing the test means that you're good at taking a test. It's pretty much it.
And right now, starting off, they're calling it what they call a light touch regulation. So the license does not have any strict requirements now.
Oh, but it has suggested requirements.
But it does have a list of things where you cannot. So rather than indicating what you must be, they have a list of things that you can't be in order to get this license. So the first one being having been convicted of fraud, dishonesty, or moral turpitude, having a judgment in civil proceedings involving fraud, dishonesty, or breach of fiduciary duty, or have mental health conditions or mental health disorders. Now, this one I want to touch on for a minute while we're here. It says that if the key officer or individual's mental health condition is properly managed and certified by a qualified physician or healthcare professional, the presence of a mental health condition will not affect his or her business entity to be licensed.
My only question is the licensing person qualified to state what is properly managed? Do you just basically have to prove? Do you have to say, I'm going to a doctor?
Well, this seems to indicate that you're going to have to reveal some of your health records for this.
Yeah.
I don't think it may or may not be simply a doctor's note that says, you know, I'm seeing this person for this disorder or whatever, and they're okay. I don't know, but I am pretty uncomfortable with that. That stipulation right there.
Yeah. How are they going to find that out? Do they have automatic access to the, are they going to get to run a background check that includes the doctors?
Well, I think what may happen is I would expect that they're going to do some kind of auditing of licenses. You know, maybe they'll pull 5% a year or something like that, or a quarter, and double check on this. Because if you're seeing a mental health professional, that, you know, there's going to be insurance claims or something like that that you file to get reimbursed for that service, or maybe you were admitted to the hospital or something like that. I think, you know, this is something that they're going to say, you're going to put on your thing, no, I don't have any mental health conditions. And then if they later find out that to be a lie, then you're going to get charged with perjury or whatever it is that they're going to charge you with in Singapore.
Huh. Yeah. Is that going to be on your license too? Like, bipolar,
mental health, but okay.
But okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, is this, I assume that this is probably going to, if you get licensed, there's probably going to be some obligation for you to present this license to customers upon request to prove that you are licensed. So who knows what that license is actually going to say. Maybe it'll just be, you know, is licensed, and that's all it's going to say on it. I have no idea exactly what that's going to look like.
Yeah. But the next item is, example.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out as this thing gets enforced. I assume that there, well, maybe not here in the United States we'll hear about it, but maybe there'll be some reporting on how exactly this gets flushed out of it as it's implemented. The next item is undischarged bankruptcies. Whether your license was revoked previously or this lovely nebulous statement, any other information that may be specified by the licensing officer in the electronic application service. You know, it's kind of like the US when they say, oh, this is for this, this law applies to this and other purposes.
Yeah. Yep.
And of course, if you fail to meet all these things, but still want to be licensed, the licensing officer would also take into consideration factors that are involved.
Yeah, like bribes. Oh, you know, this is Singapore. They probably won't take into bribes. Probably won't. Bribes is probably not a factor in Singapore.
No, not generally. And we'll get into that in a second when we talk about the freedom over there. But, you know, those two statements seem like, well, really, part of this is going to rely on whoever is working over there at the time. It's going to be a subjective element to it and not entirely objective. And of course, if the electronic application service is down, you have to submit all this in written form, which is always great, a good time.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
And all this, you know, I think this is going to discourage folks from getting licensed. You know, entry level people, you know, it depends on how they, you know, this is going to maybe even prevent some entry level people from working in the industry because they haven't gotten licensed yet in order to work in the organization that they're working at.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's that. I mean, there are people that maybe they have a mental health condition of some kind and they don't want to disclose it. They are probably not going to apply for licenses.
Yeah, I didn't think about how much of a discouragement that would probably be.
Yeah, and of course, there's the cost involved.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, depending on what the requirement is when you work for a business, this is going to, some people who may want to be independent and have their own, you know, so this is going to prevent cybersecurity from being any kind of side hustle for anybody, that's not prevention, I guess would be a too strong a statement, but this is going to discourage people from doing this on the side. And it may also discourage people from just starting doing this as their own, on their own as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to push them more towards working for a company for this. Because this, I mean, any licensing, the main problem with it is this is it's a barrier to entry. You know, this is not good free market because the free market it says that there's no barrier to entry and that's where a license fee is. You know, the I don't know if you've heard the term hang a shingle or not, but it used to be back in the day, you know, you could go wherever you wanted to and all you had to do is hang up a sign and said, hey, I offer this service, but we're long past those days.
I'm going to go be a doctor.
Sure. Why not? I mean, barbers used to be dentists, or no, dentists used to be barbers. No, barbers used to be surgeons. But as we mentioned before, they said this is going to be a light touch with no quality requirements imposed on the licensing at the outset. So right now they're just saying, cough up the money. We aren't going to do any validation to say, you know what you're, but the CSA sought feedback from a mix of local and foreign industry players, industry associations, and the public who had 30 days to comment on this before they published it. And they received 29 responses. And you're going to love the list of the key ones that I pulled out of here. Yeah. AWS, Microsoft, Mandiant, KPMG, Ernst & Young, Deloitte, the American Chamber of Commerce in Singapore, which just strikes me as bizarre. And of course, itchy scratchy, which is fairly an individual provided.
Yes, all those companies were all for this because it's less competition.
Yep, exactly. Well, that's the whole point of licensing is to reduce competition. And in their closing document, they said most of these organizations were supportive. And that kind of wrangled me initially. That these companies were supportive. But I kind of realized that, or I was thinking that, you know, they may have been supportive, and this is a stretch, but they may have been supportive because this was going to happen. Nothing they said was going to discourage them from implementing it because it was already part of an existing law, or the existing law was in place that said this was coming. And they also stated that some of the feedback they got were concerned that it would be a regulatory burden and stifle innovation. Well, what's interesting is that on their feedback page, that was in their summary, but none of the bullet points which they addressed as feedback from the people who provided feedback in there said anything about the regulatory burden or how they were going to lessen that or how the CSA felt about that complaint. But what did bother me, and this makes much more sense, is that one of the feedback that they did get from the respondents was they suggested you need to have accreditation or minimum training requirements be imposed on the staff of licensees. So not only individuals, but the companies say, oh, your staff must have these certifications. And the U.S. government is already down this path because if you want to work with the U.S. government, you have to have certain certifications for certain roles in order to be hired into them.
Yep. So the certifications are even more expensive than the licensure.
Oh, right. CSSB is, what, like $700 now or something? Yep. I don't even remember.
The difference is if you get a CISSB, you're paying somebody else, not the government.
Right. But in order to get your license, though, if they have licensure or they have accreditations or training requirements, then the barrier to entry goes up even higher because not only do you have to pay the $350 a license fee, you have to pay the $700 fee to get the certification. Plus, you have to pay both for the training, right? So it keeps rate. You know, as time goes on, the barrier to entry into cybersecurity in Singapore is going to get higher and higher and higher as they start tacking on these other things. Because they stated in here that the CSA will continue to monitor international, and industry trends and engage the industry where necessary. To assess if any new types of cybersecurity services should be included in the licensing framework. So right now it's pen tests and MSSPs, but you know, wait until this is anybody doing cybersecurity. So I was actually kind of surprised to see that this had come out because Singapore regularly rates as number one on the Heritage Foundation's Economic Freedom Index. It's down from the previous year, but it's been pretty steady in previous years as far as its ranking within the index. So it's still at number one, but that is starting to slope down. You know, considering that most people would not even, most Americans wouldn't even give Singapore a second thought and would probably be pretty surprised to hear that Singapore is number one on the Freedom Index. And you might be wondering where the United States is at. So the U.S. is
number one.
Nope. The U.S. is 25th, just ahead of Georgia and below the Czech Republic. And this is in the mostly free category. And that continues our sliding slope as we slide down that scale also. So Singapore is in the free category. United States is in the mostly free category. And this is out of 177 rankings. And as a side note, Russia is 113 and Ukraine is 130. And they are in the mostly unfree section.
Hmm.
And of course, why does anybody even care about more regulatory burdens? Is always something to keep an eye out for. It makes it harder for new companies and new people to break into the industry, but helps existing companies and people maintain their ability to exclude competition.
Yep. All right. Second article we have is a report from Microsoft about how Russia is using cyber attacks in coordination with military invasion of the Ukraine. From Dark Reading, which is a summary of a blog post from Microsoft, which is a summary of a report that Microsoft released. And we're gonna discuss
which we will summarize here.
So it's interesting. They called it some relentless and destructive Russian cyber attacks, which is interesting. I thought, considering most people have considered this to be a much less destructive cyber war than they expected. So I don't know if that, I don't know.
They're destructive here is those couple instances of wiper malware that were found, really.
Yeah. So what they found is they found 6 Russian-aligned nation-state actors have launched more than 237 operations, including destructive operations, intelligence operations, and espionage operations. They called in different parts of it, they called them Russian-aligned or and nation-state actors and APT.
Yeah, it's weird because in the article, it actually says 6 Russian-aligned nation-state actors. I'm like, well, which is it? Are they Russian-aligned or are they nation-state?
Yeah.
Because I don't think they're talking about Belarus.
Yeah, that's fair. So I grabbed a couple of bits out of here because as much fun as it would be to go over the entire article, in great detail, I grabbed a couple parts. So in early 2021, during the military buildup, they saw large-scale phishing by Nebelium and Ghost Rider. Nebelium targeted intel on military and foreign partnerships. That makes total sense. Ghost Rider targeted military email accounts and networks. Again, that makes total sense. Mid-2021, they had moved and were different groups were now targeting supply chain vendors in Ukraine abroad. That makes sense. It'd be interesting. And I expect that they'd want to disrupt, delivery of ammo, delivery of food, snarl up the logistics. That makes sense. One APT actor compromised the network of the IT firm that built the resource management system for Ukraine's Ministry of Defense. That makes sense. They also started targeting humanitarian workers and orgs. That is kind of interesting. But again, when you think about it, the United States and a lot of other Western nations consider like humanitarian orgs and a lot of those supporting organizations to be out of bounds for the military. But if you really think about it, like if they're providing aid and comfort to your enemy in the middle of a war, why would you consider them to be out of bounds? They're helping your enemies out.
Well, some of them are also direct cutouts from the U.S. government, like USAID. And some other organizations. If you remember a few years ago, Russia kicked out a whole bunch of NGOs because of their affiliation with the United States government.
I was not aware of that, but that doesn't surprise me really. Does not surprise me at all.
So one day before the invasion, which would have been the 23rd of February, wiper attacks were seen on hundreds of government systems or hundreds of systems in government, IT, energy, and financial institutions.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised it was only hundreds. I mean, they knew the attack. They knew that the war was coming for at least a year. And I'm surprised that they were only able to get into hundreds of systems, really.
Well, it could be that those were more targeted to say, well, during this phase of the war, that these institutions are going to be more important to have their systems wiped or whatever. Directly impacted the initial invasion efforts versus doing a broad swath attack. It's like they're bombing. They are doing carpet bombing like the United States does. And they're just hitting certain parts. So they're more discriminating in their targeting. I think it is why this number is probably down.
It makes me wonder a little bit about what happened back in 2015, 2016. What was that? What was that one that went a little crazy?
Oh, the NotPetya?
Yeah, NotPetya. I wonder if that made them rethink and be like, maybe we don't release wormed malware out on the internet this time.
Yeah. Well, it could be that it's possible they just messed that one up because I would imagine that it's almost like biological warfare. If you let that out of the bag, there's no stopping it from attacking you. Yeah. So if they had controls within there to say, oh, well, you Russian IP space is out of bounds, maybe they just failed to think it through and say, oh, well, maybe we need to, rather than do a blacklist to say which IPs you can't attack, maybe we should put in a whitelist to say which ones you can. So maybe they learned a lesson. I don't know. Someone also did take that and modify it to their own ends too.
Yeah. What I found really interesting is that first week, the day before the invasion, there was a whole bunch of wiper attacks. The first week, they had 22 incidents. So each incident they said was a organization involving 3 malware families. Included in that first week was an agricultural firm as part of an effort they believed to damage the economy of Ukraine. And they included in their World Bank estimate was the war would shrink Ukraine's economy by 45%. They included in here an estimate the 2020 GDP of Ukraine was $155 billion, bigger than Arkansas, Arkansas, but smaller than actual Kansas.
Right. I thought you would like that joke.
I like Arkansas.
You got Ken down there.
Yep. Arkansas is a lovely state, actually. I'm a big fan of the Ouachitas. The mountains down there are nice.
Anyway, I don't know. When I was at Fort Smith, that was way more that fun for me. But
that's fair.
So that would put their if their GDP shrinks by 41.5%, that would put their GDP at 85 billion, which would also mean that the U.S. aid that Biden has just pledged would mean that we're providing 54%. Or 46 billion of their estimated GDP.
That's ridiculous.
You are not kidding.
Wow. All right. What is interesting is that the levels of incidents since then, the report has like week by week details that would be really boring to read off of, but the week two had zero orgs hit. And then the weeks since then have been, you know, 4 orgs, 6 orgs hit, but it's been a lot lower. There's been a lot lower level of activity.
Like a big effort up front and then kind of tapered off to nothing afterwards.
And then tapered off and it's been slower. And I don't know if that's because they had a whole year to kind of prep and get in there. And that way they could do a really big effort to start off with or.
Well, it could be what they found was that big effort had no payoff. You know, imagine that they spend all this money or effort or whatever at the outset and, you know, got nothing out of it. So this is really not helping our war effort at all.
I'm so surprised that it didn't. Although I guess there were a lot of reports that the wiper malware wasn't nearly as effective. But I can imagine if the wiper malware was effective, that would have really snarled a lot of Ukraine's efforts in that first week of the war. If a lot of their, you know, Ministry of Defense, if their logistical organizations all lost the ability to quickly and efficiently manage their logistics.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is all speculation too, because I don't know, you know, we don't know what their intent was, what they wanted to accomplish with that. So maybe it was maybe they were successful and don't need anything else, or maybe it was a complete failure and they're not going to follow failure with more failure. It's hard to say because you don't know what the intent was for the effort. And since there's so much propaganda on both sides about what's going on over there, you know, because obviously Russia would play up the fact that they did this thing and were successful at it, and Ukraine would play it down and play it, say, oh, it wasn't that big a deal or whatever. So it's hard to figure out what the ground truth is about what actually the outcomes are. You can only look at what happened and then make some guesses about, you know, why it looks the way it does.
Yeah. Speaking of guesses about why it looks the way it does, the vast majority of the operations mentioned in here were intelligence, espionage, and destruction, but there was one disinformation operation mentioned in here. 1 week, they talked about an email supposedly sent from a, quote, resident in besieged Mariupol that blamed the Ukrainian government for abandoning them and suggested resisting the government, unquote.
You know, I wonder, you know, what their evidence here is that was actual disinformation. You know, if they looked at the email headers and found that it came from actual Russian source or whatever, because Russia has basically taken Mariupol at this time. So you can certainly understand why someone who's actually in the city might say, hey, you've abandoned us. What's going on?
Yeah, I guess I suppose I could see that. I think at this point,
I think I would kind of be pissed. If it looked like they were really not helping, it's hard to say. I mean, the problem is that this report is almost a black box in and of itself. We're going based on what Microsoft said.
Yeah. I can't imagine there's a single person supporting Russia in that entire city or what's left of it anyways.
Yeah. Well,
that was sarcasm. I could imagine there would be at least one person.
But I watched a video earlier today where this Ukrainian news guy was talking to people in Mariupol. And this one old dude said that the Ukrainian governments were, he put it, American henchmen.
That's funny. All right. So MS, then finally at the end, they had some items on what they did. They did a couple things. They have started proactively adding countermeasures based on the observed attacks. The big one they mentioned is to enable controlled folder access. Apparently that is a function in the Microsoft Defender that is not enabled by default, but it does help mitigate wiper malware. They've been integrating Intel to block tool usage as they've seen it, and they've been keeping the US government updated with EMPO, and they've communicated data around the threat actor spread beyond Ukraine. Apparently, as time goes on, they've been seeing more and more of these tools and this usage outside of Ukraine.
You know, what just came to mind was, I wonder if they're so civic-minded that Microsoft has given them all the E5 license for free.
I was talking with somebody the other day who, again, this is like hearing from someone who heard from someone else, that they upgraded to E5 and it like took care of their phishing problem.
I assume they're on 0365.
Yeah, of course, E5 is super expensive. So,
right. Because Microsoft can say they did it, I'm guessing they didn't. Because just by offering these guys a bunch of different free licenses could make a big difference. Because I know the difference between E5 or E3 and E5 as far as cybersecurity controls go is pretty big, huge. So if they'd offer those licenses for free and able to leverage that stuff, you know, the different controls within Microsoft Defender and all that could be a big deal.
Yeah. So why does this matter? Well, obviously, you know, Ukraine and Russia's in the news, but military targets have always included economic targets explicitly. Even in these days of, you know, smart bombs and targeted strikes, Russia is still hitting economic targets. Even if they're not hitting it with bombs, they're hitting them with malware, wiper malware, and other things. So if you work for a company, you might be a target of a military style attack. Additionally, Microsoft thinks that the environment of urgency, as both sides continue to try and pursue their military goals, will force both of them to bring out more and more secretive capabilities to get the intelligence they need and to create the impact they desire, which will create some churn in the current tactics of attackers, because as they bring out these more secretive capabilities, this is going to force, you know, defenders to start pumping out blocks faster, you know, patch vulnerabilities faster. And then that's going to force them to release new zero days, new capabilities, et cetera, et cetera. And Microsoft is seeing more attacks outside of Ukraine against countries that are providing Ukraine with assistance. And this is kind of interesting because, again, like I was mentioning earlier, this is what I was talking about earlier. Like from Russia's perspective, like when we're sending Ukraine assistance, like we're all like, oh no, we're not participating in the war. But when we're sending, you know, the Ukraine hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars worth of missiles and food and aid, from Russia's point of view, we're kind of part of that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when does the amount or the kind of aid reach the level where you're then considered a co-belligerent in whatever activities are going on?
Yeah. Because if we send them a shipment of 500 anti-tank missiles, at what point does Russia want to bomb that? They want to bomb that like as far away from the battlefield as possible to prevent it from hitting the battlefield, right?
You would think so.
Yeah. They don't want to let that thing get anywhere close to the battlefield if they can avoid it.
Yeah, because right now I believe it's, you know, as soon as it crosses the border, it's fair game. You know, but you know, when does that decision change to say that they're gonna start on the other side of the border? I certainly hope not soon, because that's gonna blow things off. You know, blow the doors off this whole thing.
Yeah.
And this actually kind of reminded me of, you ever seen the movie The Way of the Gun?
I have not, although I see that Sarah Silverman plays a character called the Raving Bitch.
Yeah. It's a good movie. You should watch it sometime. But actually, I can't believe how old it is. It came out in 2000. But there's a scene where Benicio del Toro and Ryan Phillippe are leaning on this guy's car, and Sarah Silverman is the owner's girlfriend. And she comes over talking smack about them sitting on the side of the car, expecting them to fight her boyfriend. And instead, Ryan Phillippe punched her straight in the face. First time I saw it, I just busted up laughing. It was so hilarious because she obviously had no expectation that she was going to be involved in the fisticuffs. But she went over there talking all sorts of trash about, you know, these guys. And if you watch the clip, which will be in the show notes, you can see exactly the level of her trash talking that got her punched in the face.
All right. So the recommendations they provide at the end are the same things that are always the recommendations, which is really unfortunate because that means we're terrible at actually getting those things done.
Yeah. You know, I actually think if Microsoft, like I said, was going to make a difference, they would provide them the tools that are in the E5 license.
It's actually a good call out. I wonder why they don't.
Well, it costs money.
Obviously. But it doesn't for them. Like, if those people aren't going to do it anyways.
No, I'm saying it costs them money because they want to charge them for it.
Yeah.
You know, Ukraine's getting a whole bunch of dollars dropped on them right now. Microsoft's probably saying, hey, well, why don't you use a couple of those dollars on buying this upgraded license?
Boy. Yeah, maybe that's it. That's ridiculous. That doesn't surprise me, but that's ridiculous. All right. Well, that looks like that is all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Psych on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.